The Devil's Arithmetic, Disc 3.
Chapter 10. Look, Shmuel cried over the noise of the singing. At his voice, everyone suddenly quieted, following his pointing hand. Ahead of them was a train station, its windows sparkling in the bright spring sun. There were armed guards standing in front of the station house door and scattered around the periphery. Two wooden boxcars squatted on a nearby siding. The trucks pulled up to the station house. Jumping out of the cabs, the soldiers called up to the villagers. Get out! Out! Quickly! When no one moved, the soldiers raised their guns. Shmuel put his hands on the raised panel and leaped down. Yitzhak handed his son down to Shmuel, then jumped down himself. The other men climbed out, turned, lifted their arms to take the children. Then the women and girls, clumsier in their party skirts, climbed down with help from the men. Fega's wedding dress caught on a protruding nail. When she had to rip it loose, she began to cry and couldn't be comforted. Quickly, quickly, the soldiers called, gesturing with their guns. Rounding up the villagers, they herded them toward the trains. There were piles of things spread out along the tracks, as if they'd been dropped by a fleeing army. Hannah saw suitcases and carpet bags, some carefully packed and some with their contents spilling out. Dresses and shawls were scattered around, and there was a bag of what looked like medicines, several dozen jewelry cases, a sack full of milk powder, even a small chest of baby toys. That's Grandma's satchel, Fega shrieked, pointing to a tapestry bag with wooden handles. Papa! Papa, they've left Grandma's things here. What will she use in the resettlement camp? Before the rabbi could answer, Hannah had turned to Gittel. I know. Don't say a word, child, Gittel pleaded. Not a word. More and more, the villagers began to recognize baskets and bags belonging to their families. But they were not allowed to stop by the piles, simply pushed closer to the boxcars. When the last of them was out of the trucks, the soldiers made a great circle around them. A high-ranking officer, but not the colonel who'd spoken to them before, stepped into the circle with them. They looked to him, and he raised his hand for silence. Now, Jews, listen. Do what you are told, and no one will be hurt. All I ask is your cooperation. His voice was ragged, as if it had been used too much recently. He had a dark blonde mustache and bad teeth. Hannah felt Gittel's arm tighten on her shoulder, and the villagers began to murmur among themselves. Hannah held her breath. If she held it for long enough, she thought she might wake up from this awful nightmare and be back safe at her family's Seder. But when she had to let her breath out at last, she began to cough desperately, and Gittel pounded her on the back. Lie down, was all she heard. What? Here, on the ground? Someone cried out. Of course, Jew, came the officer's voice. And then my men will move among you and take your papers and jewelry for safekeeping. You mean for your own keeping, a man called out. Hannah thought it might have been Shmuel. Who said that? The officer asked. When no one answered, he narrowed his eyes. The next one who speaks, I will shoot. There was silence so profound, Hannah wondered if she'd gone deaf. Now lie down, the officer commanded at last. He gestured with his hand, and the soldiers behind him made the same movement with their guns. When still no one moved, the officer very slowly and deliberately removed the pistol from his holster and pointed it at the feet of a man standing near the edge of the crowd. He fired a single shot. Dirt and pebbles sprayed up, and several women screamed. A little girl cried out, "Mama! Mama! Mama!" Hannah was suddenly so cold she couldn't move. Gittel shoved her in the back. Lie down, she whispered. Lie down quickly. Hannah fell to the ground on her stomach and didn't stir. When she finally forced herself to open her eyes, there was a pair of large boots by her head. She could hear children whimpering, and somewhere, off to her left, a woman was crying. There was a low undercurrent of men's voices. It took a moment before she realized they were praying. Hours later, or so it seemed, they were allowed to stand up again. Gittel had her hand up to her neck. There was a red mark that ran around it, as if a necklace had been torn from her. Faga's beaded headdress and her earrings were gone. Her dress was smudged and torn. Several men were bleeding from their noses, and Shmuel had a dark bruise starting at his temple. But except for the quiet snuffling of the children, a man's persistent hacking cough, and Rachel's labored breathing, no one made a sound. "Now," the officer said, smiling down at them and showing his rotten teeth. "Now, Jews, you are ready for resettlement."
"Where?"
a tremulous voice called out.
"Wherever we choose to send you," he answered.
"Get up." They stood raggedly, and the soldiers herded them toward the two stationary boxcars. They went silently, almost willingly, eager to be as far from the officer and the soldiers' guns as they could.
"But Gittel,"
Hannah whispered her protest as she stared at the two cars.
"We can't all fit in there."
"With God's help," Gittel mumbled, squeezing Hannah's hand until her knuckles hurt. The older people were pushed into the boxcars first, then the women and the girls. Someone shoved Hannah from behind so hard she scraped her knee climbing up. She could feel the blood flowing down and the sharp, gritty pain. But before she could bend over to look at it, someone else was behind her. Soon there were so many people crowded in, she couldn't move at all. It was worse than the worst subway jam she'd ever been in, shopping with her Aunt Ava in the city. She was caught between Gittel on one side and the rabbi on the other. There were two women behind her and the boards of the boxcar by her face. By bending her good knee just a little, she could see out a small rectangular space between the boards. She'd just gotten a look when the car shifted and the door was shut and bolted from the outside.
"We're locked in," a woman screamed. "My God, we'll suffocate."
Everyone began to scream then, Hannah with them. The ones by the door hammered on it with their fists, the car rocking with their efforts, but it did no good. No one came to open the door. After a while, exhausted by all the screaming and the tears, they stopped. It was pretty dark inside the car, with only small patches of light where the boards didn't quite fit together. And it was airless and hot. One of the two women directly behind Hannah smelled of garlic. Somewhere a child cried out that she had to go to the bathroom. A little while later, a smell announced that she had.
"How long?" someone called out.
The rabbi's voice replied calmly, "We are in God's hands now."
"God's hands are very hot and sweaty," Gittel said.
"How can you say such a thing?"
It was Faga. Just then, the car shook and everybody screamed.
"I hear a train," Hannah cried out.
She bent her good knee again and looked through the crack. A dark engine was coming down the track, backing toward them.
"I see it."
"God's hands, my children," the rabbi said loudly.
As the engine bumped against the two cars, shaking them and making it hard to stand, Hannah managed to twist just enough to speak directly to the rabbi.
"Please, rabbi," she pleaded, "we must do something, and quickly. I know where they're taking us. I'm from the future. Please."
Rabbi Baruch cleared his voice before speaking.
"All children are from the future. I am from the past, and the past tells us what we must do in the future. That is why adults do the teaching and children the learning. So you must listen to me when I tell you that what we must do now is pray. Pray, for we are all in God's hands.
Gittel was right, Hannah thought. God's hands were very hot and sweaty. The stench in the crowded boxcar was overwhelming. A powerful stew of human perspiration and fear and the smell of children being sick. As the train clacketed along the tracks, Hannah thought how lucky she was to be near a pocket of fresh air. Most of the others were not so fortunate. For the longest time, no one spoke. But after an hour, the silence was too depressing, and voices volunteered what comfort they could. "I can see a little bit," a man near the door said. "We're passing a town. Now I see peasants in the field." Spontaneously, several voices cried out, "Help! Help us!"
"Any reaction?" Yitzhak asked.
"Yes. They ran their fingers across their throats."
"The bastards! Do they care nothing?" a woman asked.
Shmuel answered,
"Did they ever?"
A man with a deep, rough voice spoke.
"I hear there was another shtetl taken to a railroad station somewhere in Russia."
"Why resettle Russian Jews? Russia isn't big enough for all."
"Big enough so a story could get lost there."
"So tell us, where in Russia?" Gittel said.
"Who knows where?" the man called out. "What does the where matter? The shtetl is no longer there anyway. But wherever it was, the villagers were made to lie down in trenches like herring, head to foot. And then, Lord God, they were slaughtered as they lay there by soldiers with machine guns. Lime was put on top of them when they were still warm, and the next ones were made to lie down on top of that. 6 times they made herrings, 6 times, until they were all dead."
A woman, her voice edged with hysteria, said,
"You heard. You heard. But if they were all dead, how could anyone know for sure?"
The man coughed and continued without answering her. "When they made us lie down, I remembered what I had heard."
Another woman said, "But they didn't kill us. Just made us abyssal uncomfortable."
"Uncomfortable. They took my wedding ring. They kicked my Avram in the nose. Uncomfortable."
It was a third woman. "It's just a story," the first woman said. "A nightmare. Don't tell us any more of your awful stories."
The man coughed again, then said, "Is it not written that we must bear witness?"
"What witness?" Faka cried. "Were you there? It is only gossip, vicious, cruel gossip, rumors. Shmuel, tell him it's only that."
Shmuel was silent.
"Not gossip, Faga. It's true. I know," Hannah said.
Gittel pinched her above the shoulder to silence her. The man spoke again. "The one who told me was a distant cousin. He knew someone who escaped."
"You said no one escaped," Faga put in.
"Hush," a woman near Hannah said. "The children will hear you and be afraid."
"I heard," another man began. Hannah recognized Yitzhak's voice. "I heard another story when I was in Lyansk buying poultry. There was a doctor, a fine man, very educated. He was operating in the hospital on a Christian woman. She trusted him more than her own, you see. And right in the middle of the operation, because her husband had called them in, the soldiers came and dragged the doctor away and killed him with his own instruments in front of his family."
"Did the woman die? The shiksa he was operating on?" another man asked.
"I hope so," a light voice chorused.
"No," Yitzhak said. "She did not die, and she did not deserve to die. Perhaps she didn't, Gittel said. But her husband did. And the soldiers? Monsters.
Hush, the woman near Hannah said again. The children will hear you.
The rabbi cleared his throat loudly. These are just rumors and gossip. The proverbs say, he who harps on a matter alienates his friend. Well, I heard... A man's voice came from the back of the car. He spoke so softly at first that the people near him shushed the others so he might be heard.
I heard, and reliably too, that in a town on the border of Poland, the entire population was locked in the synagogue. And then the Nazis set fire to the building. Anyone trying to jump out the windows was shot. Only there was a Pole, a good man, the Shabbos Goy, who opened the back door so a few of the villagers escaped and were hidden by the Shabbos Goy in his own house. In his own house. I had a friend who was one of the seven who got out. He told me the smell of people burning is not unlike the smell of cooking pigs.
Ha! Said Gittel. And how does he, a good Jew, know what pigs smell like cooking?
So he wasn't kosher. Or the Shabbos Goy told him.
So? How can you joke about such things? Hannah said in a very small voice.
The girl made a sound with her tongue.
If we don't laugh, we will cry.
Crying will only make us hotter and sweatier. We Jews like to joke about death because what you laugh at and make familiar can no longer frighten you. Besides, Chayala, what else is there to do?
Hush, the woman near Hannah remarked again. The children.
We could break down the doors and run away, Hannah said.
Run away?
Where, little Chaya?
To Lublin, Gittel asked.
To America, Hannah said. To be with Avram Moravitz? This is my home.
This boxcar? Hannah whispered.
Don't be impudent.
To Israel, then.
Gittel laughed, a strange, hollow sound. And where is Israel, she asked, except in our prayers?
Hush, the woman begged.
The stories continued.
Did you hear about Mostochova? A man asked.
You mean the place where they were all forced out of their houses to stand naked in the snow? Yitzhak said.
Rumors, the rabbi cautioned.
They were beaten, a woman said.
Yes, Masha is right, beaten unmercifully, and the blood on the snow. My uncle Moshe, who was there, said, was like rose petals falling.
Rose petals, he said,
the man concluded.
No more stories, Fega shouted. Nothing more will happen to us, nothing. We're uncomfortable and crowded, we're hungry, but it'll pass. We're going to be resettled, that's all. And then I will be married, with the canopy.
I heard...
Hush! Hush!
The woman near Hannah spoke in tired spurts of sound.
The children can stand no more. My child is senseless with all this talk.
A voice close to her said quietly,
Let me take the child, mother. I will hold her for a while.
There was a small movement as everyone tried to adjust. Oh, my God. The child is not senseless. The child is dead.
Baruch Dayan Emes. Blessed be the righteous judge.
Hannah wept. Chapter 11. The boxcars traveled for 4 days and nights. The only difference that Hannah could tell was in the heat. Under the midday sun, it was like standing in an oven that smelled of human sweat and urine and feces. But at night, when it was cold, they were all grateful for the close quarters.
The train made only 2 stops the entire time. At Tronjat, a small station that one of the men recognized, the doors were suddenly thrown open, and they tumbled out into the darkness onto a gravel path. That was when they discovered that 3 old women had died, and a 4th was near death and couldn't climb out of the car. All 4 of the bodies were slung out by the soldiers onto a siding. The dead baby was torn from its mother's arms and cast behind a horse's watering trough. The child's mother began to wail, but her husband slapped his hand across her mouth, whispering, "Hush. A bucket of filthy trough water was passed around, and everyone grabbed for it eagerly. Hannah managed a mouthful before it was taken from her. There was hay in that mouthful, but she didn't care. She'd never tasted anything so sweet. A feeble pounding came from the other boxcar. "For God's sake," Shmuel cried out, "open the doors for them." But the soldiers ignored him, hurrying the bucket along. At the 2nd stop, they heard the grateful cries of their neighbors as they were led from the other boxcar. But pound as they might on the slats, their own door remained shut. "Monsters!" Gittel said, her voice a croak. "Monsters!" It was the last thing any of them said on the moving train. On the 4th day, the train slowed. The noise of its wheels a terrifying shriek. Hannah felt hope, like a small bubble, rise from her empty stomach. Her mouth was so dry, she could feel her tongue as big as a sausage between her teeth. Letting out a deep, sighing breath, she heard echoes of that sigh all around her. The train jerked to a stop, and the silence was like a prayer. Into that silence, the raw scraping of the doors being pulled open was as loud as thunder. Air, fresh air, rushed in. Hannah tried to suck in as much as she could. "Raus! Raus, schneller!" came the harsh command. "Out! Out! Faster!" They scrambled out of the boxcar to stand blinking in the early morning light. Hannah's knees trembled from the effort of moving, and her head felt light from all the fresh air. When she looked around, she could see how weakened everyone was. Only Gittel, her dark green dress crumpled, the white collar torn, held her head high. She had an arm under Fega's, steadying her. Fega's white wedding dress was badly stained, front and back, and she was as pale as paper. Yitzhak, carrying both his daughter and his son in his arms, was still gulping at the air. The children didn't move, and Shmuel, Hannah couldn't find him. Then she saw he was still standing in the door of the boxcar. "There are more dead here," he called. "Leave them," a soldier said, slamming his rifle butt into Shmuel's shins. "Get down." Shmuel got down painfully and hobbled over to Gittel's side. He put his hand on Hannah's hair tenderly, but it felt as heavy as a weight. "There are 5 old women from Vyosk, and old Shimshon, the tailor, in there," he whispered. Then, under his breath, he muttered, "And a child."
"Baruch Dayan Emes," Gittel said.
"Down there!" a soldier shouted, gesturing with his rifle. Part of the moon still hung in the sky, a pale halo over his blonde head. Hannah followed the line of his pointing gun. Below them, down a gravel embankment, was a stark line of low barracks. She tried to count them. They seemed to go on and on. A barbed wire fence surrounded them. To the side of the barracks was a small, pretty house where early spring flowers were opening. A wrought iron gate stood in front of the buildings, and over the gate was a sign proclaiming in large black letters, "Arbeit macht frei." Several of the villagers whispered the words, but the rabbi, his hands up to his eyes,
strained to read them. "What does it say, Fegula?" he asked, clinging to his daughter's hand. Suddenly an old man.
"My eyes..."
But Fega was beyond answering. It was Hannah who told him, her voice bitter.
"Work makes you free," she said.
The rabbi nodded.
"See, my children," he said hoarsely. "We're in God's hands. We're not afraid of work."
Behind him, the Barchan whispered, "This is the devil's work, not God's."
"Down there!" the blonde soldier called out again. "Schnell!"
They were forced by the soldiers to scramble down the high gravel embankment, and the slippery stones slid away underfoot. Hannah went down on her bad knee and cried out once. Behind her, Fega tried to sidestep so as not to bump into her, stumbled, fell, and began to roll faster and faster downhill until she hit the bottom with a horrible thudding sound. Her white skirts were rucked up over her thighs. Shmuel ran after her, knelt by her side, and cradled her in his arms. Smoothing her skirts down, he whispered, "My bride, my bride." Fega didn't move.
"Get up, get up! Men to the left, women to the right!"
All the soldiers were shouting now. One pushed Shmuel to his feet. The children were torn from Yitzchak's arms and shoved toward the women's group. Little Reuven began to whimper, but the girl, Zipporah, was silent. It was Gittel who pulled Fega up. Fega looked dazed. Tears ran down her dirty cheeks, leaving gray runnels. Hurrying over, Hannah offered to help.
"What can I do?" she asked.
"What can any of us do?" Fega murmured.
"See, I was right," Hannah whispered to Gittel. "Why didn't you believe me? I was right all along. We should have run."
"Run?" Fega said, catching the last word, and repeated it in a soft, uninflected voice. "Run?"
Gittel shook her head. "There is nowhere to run, Fega. We are where we are. Hush!" Then she turned her head and stared at the soldiers.
"Monsters," she said,
loud enough for them to hear.
"You are Zugangi, newcomers, the lowest of the low," the tall, dark-haired woman said to them as they huddled in the stark barracks room. She was in a blue dress with green piping, and the short sleeves displayed a long number tattooed on her arm.
"But that number, then you're a prisoner too," Hannah blurted out.
She'd been thinking that they would have to wear striped pajamas, like the prisoners in the old photographs, yet she'd seen no one dressed like that in the camp yet. Maybe that meant her memories were false ones. Maybe things wouldn't be as bad as she feared.
"I am a prisoner, yes," the woman said. "But I am not a Jew. See."
She held up her arm so that the blue number was plain. Whatever it was they were supposed to read there baffled the women, and they murmured together.
"Quiet! You do not speak unless spoken to. I am a prisoner, but you are Zugangi, newcomers. And one of the first lessons you have to learn is not to call attention to yourselves. You, girl, who spoke out, you will give me those blue ribbons in your hair."
"No," said Hannah, surprised at the vehemence in her response. "They aren't mine to give. You can't have them."
The woman came over to her and slapped her hard on both cheeks.
"You never say no here, not if you want to live. I will have those ribbons. They go with my dress."
Hand on her burning right cheek, Hannah drew in a deep breath, willing herself not to cry.
Gittel poked Hannah in the side and whispered, "Give them to her. What do two little ribbons matter?"
Swiftly she began to unbraid Hannah's left braid. Reluctantly, Hannah undid the right.
"Good,"
the woman said, stuffing the ribbons into a pocket in her dress.
"And now you will all go in there." She pointed down a narrow hall. "Schnell, it is a most important word that you should learn.
Whether I say it or the Germans say it, it is to be obeyed. Schnell.
They hurried through the hall and found themselves in a kind of amphitheater. Hannah noticed Schifre and Jente standing together, holding hands. Esther was next to a tall, scowling woman, probably her mother. The woman in the blue dress was speaking again.
Quiet, quiet, she shouted, putting up her hands. Now, since you are all filthy from your trip, you must take a shower. You will undress here. Help the children. It must be done quickly. Quickly!
What, here? Gittel asked.
In front of each other?
The woman looked disgusted.
You have not learned the first lesson yet. You will not last here.
Gittel stared at her. I will last, she said, her voice low.
Now, all of you, undress. Schnell, pretend you are in one of your ritual baths. Oh, yes, I am not a Jew, but even I have heard of it. What do you call it?
Mikvah, murmured Esther's mother.
Yes, mikvah, the woman said. Then this is your mikvah in preparation for your new life in the camp.
She smiled and left. Some of the women sat on the wooden benches and began slowly to take off their shoes and stockings, but Hannah stood in the center of the room, staring around.
"Don't you understand?" she cried. "There are no showers. There are only the gas ovens. They will burn us all up."
Two benches away, Esther was crying softly as she took off her right shoe.
"There are no ovens, Chaya. Don't try to frighten us. We're frightened enough."
Hannah started to answer, but Gittel pulled her down to the bench. "She's right, child. What is here is bad enough. Let us live moment by moment. There's no harm in dreaming about a shower. God knows we could all use one."
Hannah was furious. They had to listen. She would have to make them. What use was her special foreknowledge if no one would listen? Maybe they thought her strange or sick or even crazy. But she was none of that. She was from the future, somehow. She could summon up those memories by trying really hard. She knew she could help them all, if only they would let her.
Then she looked up. The women and the other girls were shyly, painfully, slowly taking off their clothes. Hannah thought they looked so vulnerable, so helpless. Yet they had a kind of innocence about them, and a kind of hope. All they were looking forward to was the shower. Biting her lower lip, she thought what her knowledge of the ovens, of the brutal guards, of names like Auschwitz and Dachau could really do for them here, naked and weaponless, except to take away that moment by moment of hope. Maybe Gittel was right.
We are where we are.
She wouldn't add more to their misery. She bent over and untied her shoes. They waited nearly 20 minutes in the cold room, and the silence was frightening. Beside Hannah, Gittel began to sing a quiet song about dreaming. "Dreaming is better, dreaming is brighter," she sang. Esther, Jente, and Schifre joined in. Hannah looked around the room, then leaned over and whispered to Esther,
"Where is Rachel?"
Esther kept on singing, but tears ran down her cheeks.
"Dreaming is brighter."
"Where is she?" Hannah insisted,
though her question seemed to lack authority, with both of them sitting naked, goosebumps scattered over their arms and thighs. Esther stopped singing all at once and looked down at her bare legs. At last she spoke.
"Rachel always had trouble breathing in the spring."
Hannah remembered the peculiar, breathy hesitations Rachel had made when she spoke.
"Did she have trouble breathing in the boxcar?"
Hannah asked. She began to shake even before Esther's answer, though she wasn't sure why.
Is she... dead?"
"Dreams are better," Esther sang, her voice breaking on a high note.
Hannah opened her mouth and found herself sucking in air in great gulps. She couldn't stop. After about 7 big breaths, she said to no one in particular, "I should have told her she was my best friend. I should have said yes. I..." Suddenly the doors were flung open, and 2 soldiers marched in, their boots loud on the wooden floor. "Achtung!" one shouted, a young man with a wandering left eye. The girls screamed, turning their backs, and the younger women tried to cover themselves with their hands. Fega bent over at the waist, and her long black hair was like a blanket over her. The older women didn't move. "Into the showers," the soldier with the bad eye called. "And then you visit the barber." Hannah stood slowly thinking, "I will be brave. I am the only one who knows about the ovens, but I will be brave. I will not take away their hope, which is all they have. I will not tell them that the Nazis often lied and said people were going to take showers when they took them to be killed." Her legs were weak. She felt she could not make 1 foot go in front of the other. She was glad that Gittel's hand was at her elbow the entire time. The showers were ice cold, but Hannah was so relieved it was water and not the gas she'd expected that she stood under the sprinklers a long time. She tilted her head back and opened her mouth, drinking in the cold drops until her belly was full. Suddenly the showers were turned off. "Schnell! Schnell!" the soldiers shouted, ushering them back, without towels, into the cold room. Head down, hands over her breasts, Hannah walked through the line of soldiers, remembering how childish she'd thought the blue dress, and longing for it. Their clothes were gone. With nothing to dry themselves and no clothes to put on, they waited, shivering, in the bare room. The children began to make small whimpering sounds, and Hannah had to stop herself from joining in. Just then the door from the outside opened, and a soldier escorted a short, dark man into the room. "Here is the barber," the soldier said. "You will make a line for him, and he will do his job. There will be no noise. Remember, no hair, no lice." "Lice," Hannah thought. "We have no lice." The barber was clearly a prisoner. His own head was shaved, and with the bones so prominent on his face, he looked to be all forehead and nose. He cut their hair without any discernible skill, often pulling great clumps out with the blunt scissors. Schifre's 2 pale braids came off whole, landing with a soft thud-thud on the floor. She touched one with a bare foot, as if the plait were some sort of unknown animal. Fega's curls, tight from the shower, scattered across the floor like patterns in a rug. Little Tzipora screamed in terror at her turn, until a woman held her tightly. When the man came to Hannah, she bit her lip so as not to cry and kept her eyes closed the entire time. She concentrated on what was to happen next, after the showers and the haircutting, remembering from the lessons in Holocaust history in school. But as the scissors snapped through her hair and the razor shaved the rest, she realized with a sudden awful panic that she could no longer recall anything from the past. "I cannot remember," she whispered to herself. "I cannot remember." She'd been shorn of memory as brutally as she'd been shorn of her hair, without permission, without reason. Opening her eyes, she stared at the floor. Clots of wet hair lay all about. Dark hair, light hair, short hair, long hair, and 2 pale braids. Gone. All gone, she thought again, wildly, no longer even sure what was gone, what she was mourning. She looked up and couldn't recognize anyone in the room. Without their hair, all the women looked the same. "Gittel,"
she cried out, speaking the one name she recalled. Kittel, where are you?
Her voice cracked, and without meaning to, she began to sob almost soundlessly. Someone's arms went around her, and the touch of skin on skin made her shiver. Everything felt strange, alien, as if she were on another planet, as if she were on the moon.
Kittel?
She whispered to the stranger with the shaved head who was holding her.
Yes, child,
Gittel answered.
But promise me you will cry no more before these monsters.
We will never cry again.
Never,
Hannah agreed, wiping her eyes with the back of her hand and feeling stronger because of the promise.
Never.
Chapter 12.
They sat on the benches, naked and cold, for a long time while the barber worked on each in turn. Hannah glanced around cautiously. With their hair gone, they all looked like little old men.
She wondered what she looked like herself, resisting the urge to put her hand up to her head again. She wouldn't think about it. Thinking was dangerous. In this place, she would not think. Only do. After a while, time seemed to lose its reality. Only the snick-snack of the scissors and the occasional cry of the barber's victims marked the minutes. There was a dreamlike feeling in the room, as if, Hannah thought, anything might happen next. The woman in the blue dress entered the far door and stood for a long moment examining them all with a sour face. Hannah happened to be facing the door when she entered and, without meaning to, locked eyes with her. It was the woman who looked away first, calling out,
"Schnell! Into the next room! You must have clothes!"
She turned abruptly, signaling with her hand. For the first time, Hannah noticed that she had only 3 fingers on her right hand.
"I wonder how she lost those fingers," Hannah thought. Was she born that way?
Then remembered she wasn't going to think. She rose with the others and shuffled out of the room after them. For the first time, Hannah allowed herself to feel hungry. But when she began to wonder about when they might be fed, the still, small voice reminded her, "Don't think. Do." She reached out and found the hand of one of the children. Silently, she squeezed the child's hand for comfort. The room they were herded into was a small, low-ceilinged place with a single window high up under the eaves. It reminded Hannah of an attic somewhere. She couldn't remember where. An unadorned light bulb dangled down over several long wooden tables piled high with rags.
"Schmattes," whispered a woman behind Hannah in a hoarse voice.
"Choose,"
bellowed the 3-fingered woman in blue.
"Schnell!"
Hannah took her turn at one of the tables and started to paw through the clothes. They were ragged and worn and smelled peculiar, with a lingering, dank odor, part old sweat and part something else Hannah didn't even want to guess at. She hesitated.
"Choose, Jews! You cannot be fancy now."
"Don't think. Do."
Hannah put her hand onto the pile and came up with a dark gray dress with a dirty white collar and cuffs. There was a ragged rip along the hem and deep perspiration stains under the arms. Looking around, she saw that the other women were already slipping into whatever they had chosen. She raised the gray dress over her head and pulled it down. The material was silky and a bit stiff where it was stained. Buttoning the 3 buttons in front, she remembered suddenly how she had thought the dark blue dress Gittel had given her ugly. How she'd called it a rag. Even that small return of memory was a comfort. She'd called the dress a rag. She hadn't known anything about wearing rags then. Her arms strained the sleeves of the gray dress.
"Help the children," someone near her whispered.
It sounded like Gittel. Hannah glanced down at the naked child by her side. Was it Zipporah? The poor little thing had her thumb in her mouth. Her eyelids were a bruised bluish color, and she swayed where she stood. Hannah rummaged quickly through the pile of clothes and found a blouse and jumper that looked as if they might fit. The child made no move to help, and Hannah had to dress her as if she were a doll, pushing her arms into the sleeves of the blouse as gently as she could. They were herded directly into another room and made to line up single file. Another shaven-headed prisoner, with an odd-looking metal instrument, sat at a wooden table. There were guards at the door. Hannah could hear a mumble of voices by the table, but she couldn't begin to guess what they were discussing. Holding Zipporah's hand, she moved in the slow, shuffling, barefooted rhythm of the line. Wait. Walk. Wait. Walk. Closer to the table, she saw that the man was using the instrument to write something on each woman's arm. Strangely, no one protested or drew their arm away. Another memory, hazier than the one about the dress, flooded back to her. This! She heard a familiar man's voice crying out. I'll give them this! She couldn't think who it was, or what he was giving to whom. When she turned to see who was speaking, everyone behind her was silent, staring at the floor. Next. The man meant Hannah. She walked up to the table and sat down on a chair by the side of the table. Tell me your name, the man said. I will give you a number in exchange. That seemed simple enough, but she couldn't think of a name. There was none that came to her. From behind, Gittel whispered hoarsely, Chaya. Chaya Abramovitz. She said it aloud. Chaya. It felt, and it did not feel, like hers. The man looked at her, and his eyes were the saddest she'd ever seen, a muddy brown, like river sludge. His mouth was puckered and old. It dropped open as easily as a slot in a machine, and a sound, not quite a cry, came out. I knew it would come, he whispered. Someday. The Malach HaMavis.
What? What? Hannah asked.
That is my daughter's dress you are wearing, Chaya Abramovitz. My Chaya. I brought it as a present for her in Lublin.
Chaya, Hannah said.
The same name, too. God is good. Your name means life. His voice broke.
Life,
Hannah repeated. He nodded, then shook his head, the one following the other like a single movement. You are Chaya no longer, child. Now you are J197241. Remember it.
I can't remember anything, Hannah said, puzzled.
This you must remember, for if you forget it, life is gone indeed. The tattooing pen burned her flesh, leaving a trail of blue numbers in her arm above the wrist. J197241. She didn't cry. She wouldn't. It was something more she just remembered. Her promise to Gittel. When the man finished the number, he reached out and touched the collar of her dress, smoothing it down gently. Live, he whispered. For my Chaya. For all our Chayas. Live.
And remember.
There was a loud clearing of a throat, and Hannah looked up into the guard's unsmiling face.
Next, he said. Little Tsipora was next, and Hannah held the child on her lap, covering her eyes with ice-cold hands and crooning a song into her ears. It was a wedding song, the only song she could come up with, something about a madness forced upon them. The words didn't matter. Only the melody, only the soothing rhythm. The child, Tsipora, J197242, lay silent in her arms. The barracks they were assigned had a long brick oven along one end and deep trenches on the sides in which sleeping shelves were placed, like triple bunk beds, at impossibly narrow intervals. Privies were outside. Hannah helped Tsipora onto one of the low shelves. There were neither blankets nor pillows, but the child didn't complain. She curled into a fetal position and lay still, her thumb back in her mouth.
"I will see if there is any food," Hannah whispered to her, "and socks and shoes. I will see if there are blankets or pillows. You sleep."
When she stood up, she saw Gittel helping Fega onto another shelf, about halfway down the building. She knew it was Fega because, even with her hair shorn, her face the color of an old book, and wearing a shapeless brown print dress, Fega had an unearthly beauty. But her eyes were strangely blank. She moved where Gittel pushed her. Gittel looked up and stared at Hannah, putting her hands on her hips, barely covering the garish flowers on the red print dress. She smiled mockingly.
"So?"
"So," Hannah whispered back. In that dark, cold place, it seemed a kind of affirmation. At that very moment, her stomach rumbled, horribly loud in the silence of the barracks room. That, too, had the sound of life. Gittel's head went back and she roared with laughter.
"How can you laugh?" Hannah asked, shocked. "How can you not?" Gittel said. "Without laughter, there is no hope. Without hope, there is no life. Without life."
"Without life." Hannah's voice trailed off, remembering the old tattooer.
"Without food, there is no life," Gittel said. "We will go and see if any of these monsters believes in food."
The moment they tried to set a foot outside, a guard blocked their way. With their Yiddish, they were just able to understand his German.
"You will not leave," he said, his baby face stern.
"We have children in here who have not eaten for days," Gittel answered.
"They will get used to it," the soldier said, as if the words were rote in his mouth. "They will get used to it."
"Just like the farmer who trained his horse to eat less and less," said Gittel.
"And just when he had gotten it to the point of learning to eat nothing at all, the ingrate up and died."
"I suppose you've heard that story?"
"I hear nothing important from Jews," the soldier said. "But I have something important to tell them. See that?"
He pointed to a brick chimney towering over a flat-roofed building where a thin line of smoke curled lazily into the air.
"That's Jew smoke. Learn to eat when it's given to you, Jew, or you too go up that stack."
"Jew smoke?" Gittel whispered. But the soldier was already closing the door against her protesting hands. Hannah bit her lip. The smokestack and the ominous black curl emerging from it, dissipating against the bright blue sky, reminded her of something, yet she couldn't quite touch it. It slipped away from her. Something about smoke, about fire, about ovens.
"Oven,"
she whispered.
"Well," Gittel said,
At least we know something.
Hannah looked up at her, the slip of memory gone. What?
That we will be fed.
When?
God only knows. And let us hope that he tells the Germans.
They turned back to stare around them, straining into the darkness of the barracks. Hannah saw that almost all the sleeping shelves were filled. The women and children lay as still as corpses.
Look, not even the thought of food tempts them, Gittel said.
Hannah could not keep herself from rubbing her eyes. The thought of sleep, horizontal sleep, suddenly overwhelmed her.
What am I thinking of? Gittel said, the heel of her palm striking her forehead. You're only a child. You need sleep as well as food.
She put her hand out to touch Hannah on the head and then, as if thinking better of it, patted her instead on the shoulder.
Go to sleep, Chaya.
Go to sleep. Hannah glanced down at her wrist.
Go to sleep, J197241, you mean?
You are a name, not a number. Never forget that name, whatever they tell you here. You will always be Chaya, life to me. You are my brother's child. You are my blood.
Hannah shook her head slowly. But neither she nor Gittel knew what she really meant by it. She rubbed her fingers across the numbers on her sore arm, as if memorizing them. Then she let Gittel lead her to an unoccupied shelf, where she rolled herself onto it, and without even minding the rough surface, fell asleep. She dreamed of roast beef, sweet wine, and bitter herbs.
This ends Disc 3.